shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians called to a higher level of understanding will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
Tonight I want to talk to you a bit about part of the book of Daniel. The book of Daniel has been the subject of probably more attack by the so-called higher critics than anything except the book of Isaiah. As usual, some of these higher critics have declared that the book of Daniel must have been written by several different people. In other words, anytime he changes the subject, they say it's impossible for one man to write on two subjects, so it must have been a different man wrote this part of the book. However, even stupid as they are, the majority of these critics have admitted that the book of Daniel is entirely the work of one author. The vocabulary and the style are so consistent throughout that they recognize that this is the work of one man. Probably the chief point of their attack on the book of Daniel is that very complicated prophecy about the doings of the king of the north and the king of the south. If you've read the book of Daniel, you remember how it goes on with the fighting back and forth, and he attacked him and so on. And it's rather difficult to tell who's he and who's him a good part of the time. So naturally, that has caused considerable puzzlement. Nevertheless, it has turned out to be a pretty accurate statement of the war that went on, the many wars, between the kings of the Syrian quarter of Alexander's empire and the kings of the Egyptian quarter of it. So from this, these critics have said, therefore the book of Daniel is necessarily a fraud. It purports to have been written earlier than 500 B.C., and it describes things that went on in this warfare, going down to at least 167 B.C., they say prophecy is impossible. Therefore, the book of Daniel couldn't have been written until after all this warfare was over, because how would he know what to prophesy until it had happened? So they say that the book of Daniel must have been written at least as late as 167 B.C. We have one reasonably reliable history of that age and that period because it was written by a man who lived during a portion of those times and in that place. He was not merely a stranger wandering through and picking up a little bit of gossip here and there, but he was a man who had access to the records. That's Josephus. Coming of a priestly family, he had access to the temple records, so that besides what he knew of his own knowledge, he could dig out the official records of all the earlier times. In his history, Antiquities of the Jews, Book 11, Chapter 8, he records that when Alexander the Great passed through Jerusalem on his way down to Egypt, that they showed him the book of Daniel because it obviously prophesied that he was going to defeat the Persian Empire. Now, Daniel went through there in 332 B.C., so it would have taken considerable foresight to show him in 332 B.C. a book that was not written until 167 B.C. For another thing, the book of Daniel is included in the Septuagint, the Greek Old Testament, which was translated from Hebrew into Greek somewhere around 250 B.C. Now that, of course, isn't conclusive because we don't have in existence today any of the manuscripts dating back that far. The earliest manuscripts have been lost or destroyed, and all that exists today are later copies and could have included later material. But for what it's worth, that's it. But now, take the prophet Ezekiel. Ezekiel lived in Babylon at the same time that Daniel was there and wrote about him. And I haven't seen any successful attack on the book of Ezekiel as not having been written until about 100 B.C. or something of that sort. In Ezekiel 14, verses 12 to 14, well, actually 12 through 20, he speaks of Daniel. You remember that in early times, God had said that if there were some good people in the city, even though the bulk of the population were wicked, that he would spare the city for the sake of the good ones who were there. He was on his way to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, and he passed by the tent of Abraham. And Abraham worried about his nephew Lot, who lived in Sodom. Abraham said, well, I know the city as a whole is wicked, but perhaps there are 50 good men in the city. Would you destroy the whole city if there were 50 good men there? God said, no. For the sake of the 50, I would spare it. Abraham said, well, maybe there's only 45 there. God said, well, if there's 45, I'll spare the whole city for their sake. And it finally got on down to 10. God said, yes, if there's even 10 good men there, I will spare it. But God's patience had been worn thin by the time we get around to Ezekiel. In this 14th chapter of Ezekiel, he says this, the word of Yahweh came again to me, saying, Son of man, when the land sins against me by trespassing grievously, then will I stretch out my hand upon it, and I will break the staff of the bread thereof, and I will send famine upon it, and will cut off man and beast from it. Though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they should deliver but their own souls by their righteousness, saith Yahweh God. It was going to be a case of each man having to be saved by his own righteousness and not by the fact that over across town there lived one good man. Here you have testimony on the part of the prophet Ezekiel in a book whose genuineness is not questioned, that Daniel was a person of some considerable standing. Now, there's been some quibble raised about that over a matter of spelling. In the book of Daniel, his name is spelled with the Hebrew letters equivalent to our English, D-A-N-I-E-L. In the book of Ezekiel, the Hebrew spelling is equal to our English letters, D-A-N-I-Y-E-L. So they say, well, you see, that proves it must have been a different Daniel. No, it doesn't prove anything of the sort. It proves that spelling was a rather hit or miss proposition at that time, as you will find many examples if you do much reading in the Old Testament. In fact, the variation is so great that the English spelling of it is correspondingly different in many places. There were no dictionaries, there were no official spellings in those days, but each man did his own spelling on a catch-as-catch-can basis, and it's not surprising that you found occasionally some differences. Look what we had in English just 300 or 400 years ago. Then, in the 28th chapter of Ezekiel, there's another reference to Daniel. The word of Yahweh came again unto me, saying, Son of man, say unto the prince of Tyrus, Thus saith Yahweh God, because thine heart is lifted up, and thou hast said, I am a god, I sit in the seat of God in the midst of the seas. Yet thou art a man and not God, though thou set thine heart as the heart of God. Behold, thou art wiser than Daniel. There is no secret they can hide from thee. So twice then, Ezekiel gives his testimony that Daniel was a man greatly respected in Ezekiel's own time. Joshua the Messiah himself vouched for Daniel as being not only real, but a prophet. In Matthew 24, verses 15 and 16, and the same thing in Mark 13, verse 14, he was telling of the signs of the end of the age. When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand. Then let them which be in Judea flee unto the mountains. So there you have our Savior himself vouching for Daniel as being a prophet. Now, of course, to these churchmen critics, that doesn't mean anything because they deny that Christ himself ever existed. They say, oh, that's just traditions that were written up a century or so later. So the answer is, if you want an absolute 100% guarantee of falsehood, take the word of these professional critics for it. What about Daniel and how did he get from Jerusalem to Babylon? A little before 600 B.C., around 604 B.C. is probably a good date, Nebuchadnezzar made his first deportation of people of Judah from the city of Jerusalem. Now, he didn't undertake to take the whole population. He simply took those who seemed likely to be the leaders of any possible new revolt, the heads of the tribes, the soldiers, the people of some influence in the community who might lead a revolt. See 2 Kings 24, verses 11 to 16. Now among these were Ezekiel and Daniel. Ezekiel was chosen for deportation because he came from a priestly family. Daniel was taken because he was of the royal family. Daniel 1, verses 1 through 15 gives you the story. I'll read part of it. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem, and besieged it, and captured it. And the king spoke unto Ashpenaz, the master of the eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel, and of the king's seed, and of the princes, young people in whom was no blemish, but well-favored and skillful in all wisdom and cunning and knowledge and understanding science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans. So Josephus, in his Antiquities, book 10, chapter 6, says that Ezekiel was among those taken, that it was a group of about 3,000 who were deported at that time. And in Antiquities, book 10, chapter 10, he says that Daniel and his three companions were part of the family of King Zedekiah, the last king of Judah. So that's the reason they were taken. Now, this was not at all unusual. Both the Bible and various ancient histories record that it was the custom among a king who conquered another city to take hostages when he went back to his own city. They would be from the royal family as a general rule and from other important people. Partly, they were hostages. If the city revolted against him again, these hostages would be killed. But partly also because they were brought up in the royal palace, and it's hard to regard as entirely enemies and bad guys the people that you've been brought up with for some time. So it served both as a menace against any possible revolt and as a means of better understanding. So this is the sort of thing that was likely. The critics have rejected the book of Daniel also because it tells of two miracles. That Daniel's three companions, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, were thrown into the fiery furnace and came out alive, uninjured by the flames, and that Daniel was thrown into the lion's den and came out alive. Now, being atheists, of course, they deny the possibility of miracles. So, in general, they say none of this happened. It was all a fraud, except for the attacks of the Seleucid kings from Syria, and that the writer had to wait till after this happened before he could write the book. Now, Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and many of the other prophets did prophesy the future. And they stated in very plain language what was going to happen. When you read it, you could believe it or not as you saw fit, but at least you knew what they said was going to happen. However, an apocalypse, while it's a prophecy of the future, is a prophecy given in symbolic language, so that unless you understand the symbolism, you get no light on what is going to happen. These professional critics invariably botch up any apocalypse because, having no faith in the Bible itself, they will not look to the Bible for the explanation of the symbolism. They try to find it somewhere else or dig it up out of their own imagination, and they're invariably wrong. The only place you are going to find a correct explanation of the Bible symbolism is in the Bible itself, and it always is given. Some of Daniel's language is not only symbolic, but it's also obscure. Now, it's one thing to say, I know exactly what he said, but I'm not sure what he meant. It's a different thing to say, I'm not even sure just what he said. And that's the thing you can be up against in a spot or two in trying to unscramble the book of Daniel. Now, his explanation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream of that great image made of the four different metals, that's very clear. It represented the four successive empires of the Babylonian succession of empires, and it was so clearly and obviously fulfilled in history. In order to confirm the accuracy of that vision, that was Nebuchadnezzar's vision. So Daniel was given his own vision, telling him the very same things. But Daniel's vision, you remember, was of four remarkable beasts, each representing one of the great empires, Babylon, Medo-Persia, the Macedonian Greek Empire of Alexander the Great, and the Roman Empire. What was prophesied was exactly the same, and again, what was prophesied was fulfilled. And for further confirmation of it, Daniel's vision of these four beasts was partly incorporated into the book of Revelation. All these are too long and complicated, including their historical fulfillment, to give at this point. So what I want to take up now is this vision of the 70 weeks. This is one which has tangled the critics greatly because they won't admit any explanation that prophesies the coming of the Messiah. First, I'm going to give you the whole prophecy as it's written in the King James Version. And you know how critical I often am of the translation of the King James Version, and yet, oddly enough, they did pretty well with this one. Here's what it says, Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 through 27. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city to finish the transgression and to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, and to seal up the vision and prophecy, and to anoint the Most Holy. Know, therefore, and understand, that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again, and the wall, even in troublous times. And after 62 weeks, shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. And the end thereof shall be with a flood. And unto the end of the war desolations are determined. And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. And in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. And for the overspreading of abominations, he shall make it desolate, even unto the consummation. And that which is determined shall be poured out upon the desolator. As we'll see when we start looking into what other translations have done with this, some of this language is a bit obscure in the Hebrew. For example, that matter to seal up the vision and the prophecy. That could have either of two meanings. Daniel was told, as to some of his visions, seal up the prophecy in the vision, because the time is not yet, or the vision is for many days. In other words, seal it closed. The first thing that critics have tried to do to twist this one up is to change the starting time. He said from the going forth of the command to restore and to rebuild Jerusalem, there would be these 69 weeks before the coming of Messiah the Prince. Well, now the first command to return and rebuild was that given to Ezra. It was in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, 520 B.C. 490 years from 520 B.C., would end in 30 B.C. And what happened in 30 B.C.? In that, it is hard to give them credit for mere stupidity, because if they had the faintest trace of honesty, they would have to read the book of Ezra, and Ezra doesn't say it was a command to return and to rebuild Jerusalem. It was authority to rebuild the temple, not the city. He wasn't authorized to rebuild the walls of the city. In fact, he did rather well in getting permission to rebuild even the temple. Jerusalem had been a very important place, a very important fortified city. It had withstood siege on many occasions. They had been conquered and made tributary by other nations at times, but they had always revolted and sought their independence. And even Cyrus wasn't eager to say, all right, rebuild the fortress, the walled city, so you can revolt again. The command given in 520 B.C. to Ezra was only to rebuild the temple, not to rebuild Jerusalem. Now, the command to rebuild the city of Jerusalem did not come until the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, and that was 455 B.C. The book of Nehemiah, chapter 2, verses 1 to 8, give you that. Now, 490 years after that is the year 28 A.D., which is the year of Christ's baptism and receiving the Holy Spirit, start of his ministry. This was explained, the street shall be built again, and the wall, even in troublous times. And that was split up into 7 weeks of years, 49 years, and 62 weeks of years. When Nehemiah came back to start the building of the city, he records in his book the tremendous trouble they had, because the people of Samaria, who were at that time pretty much in command, they didn't want a fortified city independent of them to be built there. And they not only caused all the interference they could, by writing back to the Persian kings, saying, this is rebellion going on here. Why don't you give us orders to stop it? But even when the king said, let them alone, we have authorized this, the Samaritans attacked them until Nehemiah shows that working on the walls, sometimes they had to split up the working party into two groups. One to actually lay the stones of the wall, and the other to stand by with swords and spears and bow and arrow, ready to repel attacks upon them. The street shall be built again on the wall, even in troublous times, and that's what it was. He records, by the way, that when the wall was finally finished, after 10 years, the houses were not yet built. So it's very probable that the 49 years, the 7 weeks of years, was required for the rebuilding of the city. Daniel 9, verse 26. And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. And the end thereof shall be with a flood. And unto the end of the war, desolations are determined. Now that's your King James Version. It's interesting to note the King James Version is pretty nearly right. And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city. Now he doesn't say the prince that shall come shall destroy the city, but the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the holy place, the sanctuary. Now the Roman general Titus wanted to take the temple undamaged, if for no other reason than that it was so valuable with all the gold and silver and jewels and so forth on it. But his soldiers, in the fighting that went on after they got into the city, his soldiers, against his will, set fire to the temple and burned it. So it was the people of the prince, and not the prince that came, who destroyed the city and the sanctuary. Now go on to the next verse, Daniel 9, verse 27. And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. And in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. And for the overspreading of abominations he shall make it desolate, even until the consummation. And that determined shall be poured out upon the desolator. Critics haven't done as much damage to this one as have the evangelistic preachers. If there be a possible mistaken construction, leave it to the evangelists to have it. They have really had a field day with this one, have been talking continuously, first about the Messiah, from the going forth of the command to rebuild Jerusalem until the coming of Messiah the Prince should be 70 weeks. And he was talking about the Messiah right on down through to the end when it finally brought in one other character. That was the Prince that was going to come and with his army destroy the city and the sanctuary. Nobody else has been spoken of at all in those four verses. Go to practically any evangelistic church, and the minister will tell you that now this has suddenly changed the subject. It doesn't say so, but it has changed the subject, they say. It's now talking about the Antichrist. It doesn't say so, but the ministers say it is. The Antichrist. This Antichrist is a Jew. He's going to come at the end of the times, and he is going to make a treaty with the Jews for 7 years, and suddenly, in the midst of the 7 years, he's going to break the treaty. And the Jews at that time will have rebuilt their temple and have restored the offering of animal sacrifices, and the Antichrist, when he breaks his treaty with them, is going to make them stop offering animal sacrifices. If it wasn't so tragic, it would be merely silly. In the first place, it doesn't say any such thing in Daniel. In the second place, the Bible never talks about the Antichrist. Only the preachers talk about that. The only place where the Bible uses the phrase Antichrist at all is in the first and second epistles of John. And it doesn't talk about the Antichrist there. Here's what John says. He is Antichrist that denieth the Father and the Son. And as ye have heard that Antichrist shall come, even now there are many Antichrists. For many deceivers are entered into the world who confess not that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh. This is a deceiver and an Antichrist. So all that the Bible says about Antichrist is, first, there are lots of them. And everybody who denies that Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah, is Antichrist. And where you can pick the Antichrist out of that is beyond the intelligence of man to figure out. The whole passage in Daniel, four consecutive verses, was talking about the Messiah and Titus, the Roman general, who captured and destroyed Jerusalem in the year 70 AD. Now, very definitely, this business about making a treaty with the Jews for 7 years can't apply to Titus the Roman. He never made a treaty or agreement of any kind with them, and he had none to break, so you can't find anything to support it there. Well, to invent this silly business about the Antichrist, they've got to garble up the verse. They say the Antichrist will make a covenant with the Jews and then break it. But now you go back to the verse itself, and he shall confirm the covenant with many. It doesn't say make. And you cannot find one translation that says he shall make a covenant with the many. One or two of them do say he shall strengthen or defend the covenant. The rest of them say confirm. So it is an already existing covenant which he confirms. Secondly, which covenant? Now, a covenant is a particularly solemn promise. There have been all sorts of solemn promises by all sorts of people. But this has to be one that is so important that all you need to specify is the covenant, and people are going to know what you're talking about. The trouble is they are not willing to look up the Bible to find the explanation of these things that are in symbolic language, because the Bible always explains its own symbolism. They admit they're beyond their depth when they get into the Old Testament, because they say, oh well, the New Testament is all that matters. But on this they admit they're beyond their depth when they get into the New Testament, because the answer is in the New Testament and they wouldn't read it. Who is it that confirms the covenant? Well, in the Epistle to the Romans, chapter 15, verse 8, Paul says, "For I say that Jesus Christ was a minister of the circumcision for the truth of God, to confirm the promises made unto the fathers." Promise and covenant are interchangeable terms. He confirmed what? A new and different promise? No. He confirmed the promises made to the fathers, because the Old Testament clearly prophesies that we will gain our salvation by the sacrifice of the Messiah giving up his life to pay the penalty of our sins. And that was what he confirmed, the same promise made to the fathers. What about that next phrase? In the midst of the week he will make the sacrifice and the offering to cease. Still in the New Testament, look at the book of Hebrews, chapter 10, verses 11 to 18. "And every priest standeth daily, ministering and offering oftentimes the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. But this man, after he had offered one sacrifice for sins forever, sat down at the right hand of God. For by one offering he hath perfected forever them that are sanctified. Now where the remission of those sins is, there is no more offering for sins." There's the explanation given so clearly that even a clergyman should be able to understand it. The animal sacrifices under the Old Testament did not of themselves pay for anybody's sins. They were offered over and over, and they had to be repeated because they were not the effective thing. And I think even Moses himself understood that there was no special merit in cutting the throat of a sheep. That wasn't the real sacrifice. Now, when the real sacrifice by Christ upon the cross was made, then what point of going through the useless pantomime of cutting the throat of a sheep and cremating its remains on the altar? It had served its purpose, making the sacrifice and the oblation, the gifts, to cease, was accomplished then and there by Jesus Christ, not by the Antichrist, nor by Titus the Roman. Some of them have tried to use that explanation of it, that when the siege had gone on so long that they were starving in Jerusalem, and there were no more animals left alive to be sacrificed, that the offering of the daily sacrifice at the temple came to an end. That it did. But for 40 years, the ritual of the sacrifice at the temple had been useless. All that ever was intended to be was a public proclamation of your faith that sometime in the future the Messiah would come and make the real sacrifice. Now he'd done it. All the purpose of the daily sacrifice was accomplished and was done away with. You'll note, by the way, that even the Jews, though they won't admit who Christ was, even the Jews seem to have some dim perception of this, because they have never since tried to restore the animal sacrifices. They seem to see that there's no purpose in going ahead with that. We see, therefore, that Daniel was a true prophet. That was attested to by no less than Christ himself. We see that even the difficult to explain apocalyptic things that he gave were true prophecies, and that the test, therefore, did it come to pass or not, that has been met. Now, there's a lot in the book of Daniel, and like every book that contains much material, especially prophetic, it's been badly garbled up by the churchmen. Like the book of Revelation, a large part of the book of Daniel is an apocalypse. Dreams and visions that are symbolic and not meant to be taken literally. Now, some of those are explained. Daniel was told at the time what they meant. There was Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the great image with the head of gold, the arms and shoulders of silver, the belly and thighs of brass, and the legs of iron, symbolizing the four great Babylonian empires. That is, the Babylonian succession of empires, Babylon being one. There was Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the tree, the great tree that was chopped down. There was the handwriting on the wall, interpreted for Belshazzar. And one vision that Daniel got, which we'll go into tonight, of the ram and the he-goat. Now, as to these things, Daniel was given the explanation at the time. Others, this business about the kings of the north and the south, were left in a confusion that could only be explained by history as it occurred. Daniel himself didn't understand it. His confusion is shared by today's churchmen. Daniel received two visions, some 5 years apart, which dealt with the Grecian Empire that was started by Alexander the Great. First, in the 8th chapter of Daniel, he said occurred in the 3rd year of Belshazzar, Daniel 8, verses 1 to 12. Then I lifted up my eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river Ulai a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. And he's told that's symbolic of the Medo-Persian Empire. It did have two horns, the two kingdoms, Media and Persia. Media was the leader of the two in the early stages in the attack on Assyria. But after that, Persia became more important. So one horn was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. It was an accurate symbol. I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. But he did according to his will and became great. And as I was considering, a he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran into him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with anger against him, and smote the ram, and broke his two horns. And there was no power in the ram to stand before him. But he cast him down to the ground and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Therefore the goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And for it came up four notable ones, toward the four winds of heaven. And out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land. And it waxed great even to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. And an host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. Now you note all this business is symbolic, apocalyptic. You can't take any of it literally, but it's a symbol of some greater thing. All of that, except this little horn, was explained to Daniel at the time, and is admitted to have occurred. There's no problem there. The he-goat was the Grecian Empire under Alexander. He had one great notable horn between his eyes, which is Alexander the Great. At the height of his power, it was broken because he died in a drunken debauch. In his place, his kingdom was divided into four. Now, he says divided toward the four winds of heaven, north, south, east, west, in other words, and even that was fulfilled literally. We'll consider this little horn later because it ties in with the book of Revelation. Then, Daniel chapter 10, beginning verse 1, in the third year of Cyrus, the king of Persia, there's a long and complicated revelation by the angel of many international events, and the language of it is so obscure, speaking of these kings of the north and the south and so on, and he did this and so forth, and you can't always tell who the he is from reading it. You can't tell who's doing what to whom a good deal of the time. That was left for history to determine. Daniel said he didn't understand it, and he asked an explanation. And he was told that the words were sealed up. Daniel 12, verses 8 and 9. But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. And I heard, but I understood not. Then said I, O my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? And he said, Go thy way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. So the obscurity was intentional. After the thing had happened, then you could understand because you could see that it fitted the obscure language. Now, it began with the breakup of Alexander's Grecian Empire. Daniel 11, verse 2. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all, and by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia. Now the next three kings of Persia after that were Cambyses, Smerdis, and Darius Hystaspes. Then the fourth was Xerxes, who was famous for his enormous wealth. To conquer Greece, he raised an enormous army, and it says, shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia. He made alliances wherever he could, even as far as Carthage on the north coast of Africa, to get navy support from Carthage. He did move with an enormous fleet and army against the Greeks, suffered a terrific defeat at Salamis in 480 B.C., and gave up. Next, there were nine minor kings passed over in silence. Nothing said about them to Daniel. Then Daniel 11, verse 4, And a mighty king shall stand up, that shall rule with great dominion, and shall do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken, and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be plucked up, even for others beside those. Now this is obviously the same as the previous vision of the he-goat with that one great horn between its eyes. The he-goat's horn was broken, and out of its roots grew these four smaller horns. That's Daniel 8, verses 5 to 8. The rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Now that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, Four kingdoms shall stand up out of a nation, but not in his power. In other words, with the death of Alexander, the empire as such ceased to exist. He's always held it together. It wasn't for his prosperity or his relatives, because all of his relatives were killed in the next few years in the scramble for power, trying to take over after him. And finally, four of his generals each took over roughly a quarter of his empire, each ruling his quarter separately. So you had no continuation of the Grecian Empire. You had four smaller kingdoms. Now, viewed from Palestine, the four quarters of Alexander's empire were these. The west was Greece and Macedon under his general Cassander. The east was Thrace, Bithynia, and so on. In other words, Asia Minor and east of it, clear on into Babylon, under his general Lysimachus. The north was Syria under his general Seleucus, and the south was Egypt, Libya, Arabia, and part of the time Palestine, under his general Ptolemy. Now Seleucus, heading the north, so-called Assyrian quarter, conquered and absorbed the eastern and western portions of it. So the north included three quarters of Alexander's empire. So the north and the south were all that remained of Alexander's empire. And the north, the Syrian empire, was larger and more powerful than the south, the Egyptian portion. Now you come into some obscure language, Daniel 11, verses 5 and 6. And the king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him, and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. Now that one of his princes, as we see, refers to one of Alexander's princes, not a prince under the king of the south. And shall be strong above him, because the Syrian empire was greater than the Egyptian. And in the end of years, they shall join themselves together. For the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand nor his arm. But she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times. Well, all of this proved to be true. The king of the south was strong. One of Alexander's princes, Seleucus, was strong above him. Now, the daughter of one of the Egyptian kings, Berenice, was married to Antiochus Theos, the third king of Syria. Now, he was already married to Laodice. So the king of the south, one of the Ptolemies, gave his daughter to Seleucus on condition that he divorce his first wife, Laodice, and he had children by her. It was thought that in this way the two kingdoms could be allied together because there had been bitter strife between them already. Well, it didn't work out. Later, he brought back his first wife, Laodice. And she had Antiochus himself and Berenice and their infant son poisoned so that her own son would inherit the Syrian kingdom. And she also killed all of Berenice's Egyptian attendants. She shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these things. Well, now, Egyptian history is a bit confused in there, and whether there was any connection with the death of her father isn't too certain. Remember that all ancient historical records are fragmentary. You don't have complete historical records like we do in modern times. Daniel 11, verses 7 to 9. But out of a branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate, and shall come with an army, and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against them and shall prevail, and shall also carry captives into Egypt, their gods with their princes and with their precious vessels of silver and gold. And he shall continue more years than the king of the north. So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and shall return into his own land. Well, now this again we know to be true. One out of a branch of her roots, that is a brother. Ptolemy Euergetes, Berenice's brother, came to the throne of Egypt. He did invade Syria. He captured practically all of the Asiatic Empire of Syria, even as far east as Babylon. And he also survived the king of the north by some 4 or 5 years. Rebellion broke out in Egypt, and without being able to complete his conquest of Syria, he had to return home and get things straightened out there. So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and shall return into his own land. Now when you come to Daniel 11, verses 10 and 12, you get into something still more obscure, but it worked out. But his sons shall be stirred up. Whose sons? Only history can tell you that. But his sons shall be stirred up, and shall assemble a multitude of great forces. And one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through. Then shall he return, and be stirred up even to his fortress. And the king of the south shall be moved with anger, and shall come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north. And he shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand. Now here you see this obscurity. Who sets forth a great multitude? And who is it that conquers this great multitude? And when he hath taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it. This worked out entirely true. There were two sons of the king of the north. The first one was speedily poisoned by his generals. The second raised a big army. He reconquered parts of Syria that were still held by Egypt, and he threatened an invasion of Egypt. The king of the south, Ptolemy Philopater, raised an army, inflicted a terrible defeat on the Syrian army. But Ptolemy was so ease-loving and corrupt, he couldn't stick with it. He wanted to go back home and go back to his debauched carousing at home. He didn't have enough character to stick with it and conquer the Syrian kingdom while he had it on the run. So as it says, when he hath taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it. And that worked out exactly. On this expedition, on his way back to Egypt from Syria, he came to Jerusalem, offered sacrifices at the temple, tried to force his way into the Holy of Holies in the temple itself. But the priest restrained him, and he went back to Egypt furious against the Jews. He massacred many thousands of the Jews in Alexandria. There was rebellion in Egypt, and this Ptolemy Philopater died, finally, leaving a 5-year-old son to inherit the throne, Ptolemy Epiphanes. You had an example of the hypocrisy of diplomacy here. The king of the north, Antiochus Magnus, sent to Egypt messages of sympathy and all for this poor young 5-year-old boy on the throne and how he would help him and so on. And he formed an alliance with the king of Macedonia that the two of them would go down, conquer Egypt under this 5-year-old boy, and divide the loot between them. Now, there had been 14 years of truce between Syria and Egypt at the time King Ptolemy of Egypt died, like Alexander died of drunken debauchery. All that peace and friendship meant nothing. Well, in addition to the outside rebellion, some provinces of Egypt broke into rebellion, all against this infant king of the south. So it says, "For the king of the north shall return, and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches. And in those times there shall stand up many against the king of the south. Also The robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fall. So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fortified cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall be there any strength to withstand. But he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him. And he shall stand in the glorious land, which by him shall be consumed. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her. But she shall not stand on his side, neither before him. Now that's pretty hard to unscramble, isn't it? And yet history does it. Rome was beginning to extend its power at this time. So Rome intervened on behalf of this young king of Egypt. Naturally, he had somebody ruling for him as regent and overseeing the generals. Rome intervened. First, they merely sent an embassy and a few troops. And these sent Egypt's best generals and troops against Antiochus of Syria. But they were defeated. They retreated to the fortified city of Sidon. It was one of the best fortified cities in the east at that time. So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mound and take the most defensed cities. He took Sidon, forced the army to surrender. So all the armies of the south couldn't resist the king of the north. So you can see now that obscure as this language is, so that Daniel himself couldn't understand it at the time. Nevertheless, it becomes clear when history actually occurs, and you can see that the things mentioned have actually happened. There's still more to Daniel, and as I say, some of this ties in with the book of Revelation. Not all the Bible speaks of what's happening now. The Bible is setting out its own credentials, proving its truthfulness, so that we can see it's worthy of belief. When it starts talking about our own times and talking about things that have not yet happened, if we didn't have prophecy of things that are now history, we'd be inclined to doubt the Bible. Having seen that it actually makes good, then we can take what the Bible says about our present times and consider it reliable. This is part of the background showing you that the Bible is worth relying upon.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a CD of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.